Good morning. On today's programme, Denmark summons the top US diplomat over alleged covert operations in Greenland. And as Ireland experienced hot summer sunshine, we hear about the record-breaking rainfall that drenched Australia. But first we go to Tunisia. Police acting on orders from the Italian State Prosecutor's Office are currently investigating an armed attack on the civilian sea ship, the Ocean Viking, which was on a mission to rescue migrant boats in distress in the Mediterranean Sea, when it came under fire from a boat marked as the Libyan Coast Guard. The attack is being described as the worst attack on a civilian rescue vessel to date. Alicia Voltman has this report from Tunis.
Italian forensic police have just finished their inspection of the civilian sea rescue ship Ocean Viking, operated by NGO SOS Mediterranean. Police are interviewing crew members as part of their investigation into what sea rescuers are saying is the worst armed attack at sea on a civilian rescue ship. 2 weeks ago, whilst en route to port, having already saved 87 souls from two different migrant boats in distress, Ocean Viking heard a Mayday relay. Italy's Marine Rescue Coordination Centre in Rome granted permission to investigate the case. Search and Rescue Coordinator Angelo Salim duly informed the Libyan Coast Guard Control Centre in Tripoli of their change of course and intention to investigate the distress case. Ocean Viking was 40 nautical miles north of the Libyan city of Al-Homs when lookouts saw a fast rescue boat powering towards them. In broken English, Libyan Coast Guard officers hailed them over the radio. The ship's communication officer, Lucille Guenier, said the only words they could make out were, "Out, out, out." The ship's interpreter came to help the negotiations, but on hearing his Egyptian accent, the Libyans began insulting him and his family. Looking out, Guenier realized that the Libyan crew were now pointing guns at them, and then they opened fire. Bullets were coming through the walls of the bridge. The windows were exploding with glass flying everywhere, said Guenier. The Libyan vessel kept circling Ocean Viking, raining down hundreds of bullets. The priority was to protect the 87 rescued people. Crew were ordered to escort them to the shelter, then to get to the Citadel, a secure room all ships have in the case of piracy and boarding. A British crew member called Patrick described fleeing his cabin and seeing the attackers face to face as a terrifying experience. Once inside the Citadel, he said people were in a state of shock and crying, fearing the worst. Abandoning the rescue, Ocean Viking headed full speed north, issuing Mayday calls to the Italian authorities and NATO, who told them to call on a nearby Italian naval vessel. But they didn't reply, and nobody came to Ocean Viking's aid. After more than 20 minutes of sustained gunfire, the Libyan Coast Guard stopped shooting and dropped back. The bridge was all but destroyed, and the inflatable hulls or sponsons of the fast rescue boats were deflated, peppered with bullets. Patrick said days afterwards they were still finding bullets on the deck. 2 days later, they disembarked the rescued people, but the ship and its crew were ordered to remain at anchor on the pretext of quarantine restrictions. Sadly, nothing more was heard of the boat they had hoped to rescue. Ocean Viking sails under the Norwegian flag, and its crew includes Italians, French, British, and also New Zealanders and Filipinos. Crew's governments have remained silent about the attack. Even Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, who is normally vocal about keeping migrant boats from landing on Italian shores and of her criticism of NGO rescue ships, has been notably silent about the attack. The Caribbean-class vessel that attacked Ocean Viking was a gift from Italy's Guardia Costiera in 2023 and paid for by the European Union. Italy, the UK and the EU have all contributed funding to the Libyan authorities for so-called migration management, despite being aware that Libya's security landscape is made up of violent militias renowned for their criminal activities. Only the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights Defenders, Mary Lawler, has condemned the attack. She said the attack is designed to stop their work and leave the sea clear for the rights of those seeking to cross it to be violated. The European Union's response has been lukewarm, with a spokesperson saying, "We have contacted the Libyan authorities to clarify the facts. It is their duty to say what happened." A response which offers little hope for those seeking justice. As well as the Italian investigation, SOS Mediterranean are filing their own criminal complaint against the ship's attackers. Mediterranean OSINT analyst Mark Tilley, who monitors violence at sea by the Libyan Coast Guard, said that this attack is part of a long-standing pattern of violence by the Libyan Coast Guard personnel. The attack is also a violation of the arms embargo. However, the Libyan Coast Guard is supported financially by the European Union. The outcomes of the criminal investigations will define whether such attacks are policed or become the norm, making sea rescue even more dangerous than ever before. One thing is certain, that once repairs are complete, Ocean Viking will return to sea rescue once again. For RTE, I'm Alizia Faultman in Tunis, Tunisia.
Next, we go to Australia. It's about 17,000 kilometres from Dublin to Canberra, Australia's bush capital. But despite the distance, the two countries have much in common and face significant challenges from climate change. A hot Irish summer has echoes of blistering conditions often found in Australia. But while Ireland has had some hot spells of weather this summer, parts of Australia have been unexpectedly drenched by record rainfall, as Phil Mercer reports.
Australians see Ireland as cold and wet. Australia, meanwhile, is known for being hot and dry. Recently, those stereotypes have been turned on their heads. August in Ireland was very warm, with temperatures well above average. Rainfall, though, was below what would normally be expected. It was driest in the south and east. There have been hosepipe bans and reservoir levels have fallen. In parts of Australia, however, the sun went missing. Sections of the New South Wales coastline have recorded their wettest August in 126 years. There have been numerous flood emergencies. Port Macquarie north of Sydney was drenched by 148 millimetres of rain in a single day. It was the city's heaviest August downpour on record. The weather, of course, is always capricious, but this feels different. The amount of rain has been extraordinary, not only for its frequency, but also its intensity. The influence of climate change on individual weather events, although spread over a few weeks, is difficult to assess. But patterns give us more concrete evidence. Warmer oceans and higher sea surface temperatures tend to increase the amount of moisture that's transported to the atmosphere. Evaporation and condensation form clouds. A warmer atmosphere can hold more moisture and can increase the intensity of extreme rainfall. Floods are part of Australia's natural ecology. They are the country's most costly natural disasters. While overall rainfall is predicted to fall, the severity of storms could well intensify. Government research shows that Australia is likely to become warmer in the coming decades, with a continued reduction in average annual rainfall in the south and east, where most people live. That pattern of drying certainly isn't new. Rainfall in southern Australia has decreased since 1970, but over the same period, it has risen in northwestern parts of the country. Australia is a big place. It's about 90 times the size of Ireland. From the ski fields of Victoria to the central desert and tropics, the climate varies. So do scientific predictions for their future, although not everyone agrees with them. Climate scepticism has deep roots in Australia. It's found a home in the minds of a minority. It's impossible to say how big or small it is. But what is clear is that the climate debate has been highly politicised. Some sections of the media continue to reject the scientific consensus and overlook the man-made causes behind increasingly destructive floods, droughts and bushfires. Australia is still heavily reliant on fossil fuels for its electricity generation. It earns a fortune selling most of its coal and gas overseas. Australia is highly vulnerable to global warming due to its naturally hot, dry climate and fragile ecosystems. Its long coastline is exposed to rising seas and extreme conditions. Australia and Ireland's climate challenges are very different, but they share a common goal: to adapt and prepare for an uncertain future. For World Report, this is Phil Mercer in Sydney.
Finally, we go to Denmark. Last week, the Danish foreign minister summoned the top US diplomat in Copenhagen to an urgent meeting over claims that the US had been carrying out covert operations in Greenland. The meeting came after reports that at least three US citizens with ties to President Donald Trump had been allegedly trying to infiltrate Greenlandic society to promote its secession from Denmark. Tom Carstensen has this report.
If it sounds familiar, it should. In my last reports, I talked about Trump's curious fascination with Greenland, as if geopolitics is something you can grab at a clearance sale. At first, it seemed far-fetched. Today, it feels like a warning come true. Last week, Denmark's Foreign Minister Lars Løkke Rasmussen summoned the top US diplomat in Copenhagen. The reason? Reports that at least three Americans with connection to Trump's world have traveled to Greenland to build networks and, as it was put, infiltrate Greenlandic society in hopes of loosening ties to Denmark. Strong words in any language. And the optics were striking. Cameras catching the Shasta affair, Mark Stroh walking into the ministry. Normally Denmark and the US smile for NATO photo ops. This time, Løkke made it plain. Interference in the kingdom's internal affairs is unacceptable. Diplomatic code for yellow card. Why does this matter? Because Greenland sits like a hinge between North America and Europe. Its radar stations, shipping lanes, and mineral riches are exactly what keeps generals and investors awake at night. Many US administrations, Democrat or Republican, has had an eye on the Arctic, but the way you show the interest matters. Inference operations blur the line between fair partnership and covert manipulation. Meanwhile, Greenland is having its own debate. The island has home rule, its own parliament, and the right to vote itself out of the Danish realm. That's a Greenlandic choice, not something for outsiders to engineer. And polling suggests that if Greenland does break away, it's more likely to stand on its own. International media have dug into the story. They describe how this American trio allegedly mapped out potential allies for a secession push. Denmark's intelligence service, PET, even announced it has strengthened its presence in Greenland to counter foreign meddling. That's not everyday language for the Danes. Named Trump allies have also surfaced in the discussion, openly calling for a bigger US footprint in the Arctic while cultivating contacts on the ground. Some influence is shadowy, some is loud and public. And in a community of fewer than 60,000, it all hits close. If you're hearing echoes, you're not wrong. We had the We Can Buy Greenland headlines back in 2019, dismissed, obviously, as absurd by Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen. Then again, earlier this year, with Trump and his running mate J.D. Vance floating the idea once more, and Vance going to Greenland in a fairly embarrassing show of force, as they never actually visited Greenland, but only the base that the Americans run. And as it has been mentioned many times by Danish politicians, if Washington wants more security cooperation in the Arctic, there's room for that. Denmark and Greenland host the Thule base, now called Pituffik, and have rarely stood in the way of US defense needs. That's a very different conversation from covert lobbying. The irony here is hard to miss. Denmark has marched alongside America for decades, from Iraq to Afghanistan and so on, and now Copenhagen is forced to remind an ally that friendship means respect. To put it in homely terms, when you're a guest, you don't put your feet up on the host's coffee table. From Greenland's perspective, the stakes are enormous. The island's politics are about language, education, resources, and the long-term vision of how to thrive as a tiny population on a vast land. Having superpowers knocking on the door with their grand designs makes it harder and more urgent for Washington and Copenhagen to tread carefully. So where does this leave us? For now, a cold front, Denmark drawing the line, the US officially brushing it off, both sides smiling tightly for the cameras. In the medium term, the familiar cycle of the Arctic climbing higher on America's to-do list. And in the long term, simple reality, Greenland will decide its own future. The US can be a partner, Denmark can be a partner, but no one can be the owner. And yes, it does feel like deja vu. Last time I signed off by pointing out that if America wants more bases and radars in Greenland, both Denmark and Greenland are usually very open to talks. That's still true. The difference now is that we're not talking about defense infrastructure. We're talking about influence lists, covert meetings, and shadow campaigns. That's not diplomacy. That's manipulation. And that's where Denmark drew the line last week. For World Report in Elsinore, Denmark, this is Tom Carstensen.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Margaret Curley. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or find us on all podcast platforms. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.